You are listening to Talking Machines. I'm Catherine Gorman.
And I'm Neil Lawrence.
And today, Neil, I wanted to take a minute to talk about some really interesting articles or maybe just writing that's been going on in the space. Professor Michael Jordan put out an interesting blog post or article on Medium, as did Professor Rodney Brooks, talking about, not talking about the hard science that's happening, but talking about how we're talking about it, if that sort of makes sense. But I really loved this idea that Jordan picked up on and was talking about the difference between artificial intelligence and intelligence infrastructure and how we think about these ideas and really the importance of the words that we use to talk about them.
Yeah, I think actually as I was looking for the links for this, I realized that this episode and maybe some other stuff we'll talk about next episode could be just seen as cyber stalking Tom Dietrich because he's been tweeting. He's been tweeting all these, I realized. And he's actually someone great to follow on Twitter in this space. He's a great guy for highlighting these things. But yeah, so first of all, this the Medium post by Mike Jordan, which is artificial intelligence, the revolution hasn't happened yet. And I think it reflects a lot of the things we've sort of been talking about on Talking Machines, but he does a great job really of structuring it and pulling it together. And of course, he's arguably one of the leading world experts in machine learning. And I guess that's part of the theme of it is he's pointing out that AI isn't really the same thing as machine learning and expectations a high for AI. And I think a separation we've talked about in the past is that between AI and data science. And I think that comes strongly through in Mike's post. And in particular, he mentioned an example of when his wife was pregnant and they had an ultrasound. And during the scan, they suggested maybe there was a raised risk for Down syndrome. And so they were suggesting amniocentesis. And amniocentesis does have, I think actually you can detect Down syndrome from the blood now, but those days you couldn't. Amniocentesis involves, I think, removing some amniotic fluid to look at the...
It can be dangerous for the fetus because of the sort of disruption.
Yeah.
Right?
And so there's a 1 in 300 chance, according to Mike, of miscarrying due to the amniocentesis. So it's only recommended when people are at high risk. And what Mike noticed, or he found out that the increased risk was associated with white spots on the scan. And he did some investigation in his own time, found out the scan that idea was taken from was a lower resolution scan done in the UK. And this scan was higher resolution. And he speculated perhaps that you were getting some false positives here, which seemed to be borne out certainly by the operator's experience. Obviously, it's an anecdotal story rather than a statistical one, but it's a very believable one. We see this all the time. The change in a sensing measurement, we have statistics. I mean, there's another example, a good example in the UK is there's a lot of question marks around cardiac disease risk because I think it's called Q risk in the UK. The data for that is quite old now and the population has changed and, people are unsure about how well calibrated that is, but it becomes a de facto score. So data sets change over time. Mike's really talking about all the things you need around these systems. So he talks about intelligence augmentation. He talks about intelligence infrastructure as terms we should think of. Now, he says, we'll use the phrase human imitative AI to refer to the aspiration for AI emulating humans. That's something I like to call anthropomorphic intelligence, because it really then captures it. And I think that he's highlighting this confusion, this blending of... AI as a term to mean some technologies we've got that might help in medical cases and conflating that with AI as a term to emulate what we do.
To recreate human intelligence. Yeah, he argues really beautifully for thinking of what we sort of think of in the public sphere as AI, doing some differentiation in that, figuring it out, pulling it apart, and thinking of the actual core of the science here and a lot of the work that's being done right now as creating a new branch of perhaps engineering, right, as opposed to thinking of it as this anthropomorphic human intelligence, those sorts of questions. I think it's a fascinating idea and something that would really help the public conversation.
Yeah, I think it's vital. And actually, any company that isn't doing this is going to get nowhere with AI. I can assure you of that. Because It's all the infrastructure you need, just like every other revolution depended on the nuts and bolts. Sometimes we call this internally like the plumbing.
Yeah.
How things connect together and making sure things connect safely and making sure that when data changes, models are updated. And I think engineering is a good term. It's an evolving stage of engineering. I like some of the things he says. He uses some good analogies around, just quoting, did civil engineering develop by envisaging the creation of an artificial carpenter or bricklayer? Yeah, no. I mean, it's
right.
That's quite funny. But what he's really saying there is, I mean, if you go back, and I always like to look to history for inspiration, early engineering, the processes weren't always, you know, there's big disasters in the UK from badly engineered bridges. Investigations had to take place in order to understand the right practices of how you do that. And I think that he's really sort of saying, he's highlighting some of the areas where we need that. By the way, I'm just apropos of that. Another paper I really like that maps a lot with thinking that we've been doing in my group, but it's from the General Berkeley team, is this A Berkeley View of Systems Challenges for AI. He doesn't actually mention it, I think, in this post, but it's covering more from a technical side a lot of the things that we'll need, like explainable decisions, secure enclaves, dealing with adversarial learning, and systems research. By the way, the interface of systems and ML, I think, is a super important area. Systems people are used to the everyday of delivering on this, and bridging into the systems community is a super important part of delivering some of the engineering structure. But as Mike points out, mapping into the sort of social sciences as well, as he puts it, this must be done within the context of evolving societal, ethical, and legal norms. So that involves an ongoing dialogue in society. And certainly there's institutions set up to help drive that. But I think one of the things that Mike's sort of pushing back against is the over-focus on things like the singularity. That draws attention away from the very real problems we're facing today. And he also, he has a nice run through with this story, which I think we'll come back to, John McCarthy, who coined the term and what the context of where the term was coined. We'll talk in a bit about what Rodney Brooks says about that. And we sort of see that in some sense, it was almost an accidental term, it seems, according to Rodney at any rate.
Right. Because in this post by Rodney Brooks, he delves a lot more into where this term comes from. And it's from this, probably many of you know about it. It's from this, I think it was a workshop at Dartmouth in the 50s, and they just sort of needed something to call it. I think the line is drawn directly from the title of the workshop, A Proposal for the Dartmouth Summer Research Project on Artificial Intelligence, right? And that's sort of where we see it first, coming up with a fast name to describe what the research project was going to be.
Yeah, so the, Rodney's essay, which is on his blog, which is another great blog, lots of interesting thinking. And Rodney is, he's the godfather of robotics. He's really a sort of key person in the evolution of the field of robotics, founded several robotics companies that are sort of household names. So he's been working in this field for a long time. I would say sort of, he mentions some of his work sort of going back to 1992 and earlier. What I think is interesting about this is it's more of a polemic style, I would say, which I quite enjoy. I mean, Mike, I think, is also making a point. Mike's, I think, probably if you got Mike and Rodney together, they would strongly agree about a lot of their shared positions. But Rodney is more focusing on the use of the term and how it's misleading perhaps the public. What I'm excited about, to be honest, is the quality of the discussions we're starting to get. So this is within sort of 9-10 days of each other. Super interesting pieces by experts, which are getting picked up.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we'll have links to Professor Jordan's article and also to Professor Brooks's article on our website, thetalkingmachines.com. This week's question on Talking Machines is about books and other places to find ideas around these topics that we talk about. Andrew Ng's new book, Machine Learning Yearning, is publishing chapters to an email list of interested people. And I'm on that list, and I suggest that if you are interested too, that you sign up for it. It's really fascinating stuff. Our listener asks, is there a good book to read about the history of these ideas that's perhaps less focused on the computer science and more about the people or the characters. I'm going to jump in on this one because you know that I have a favorite that is sort of the reason that we started this show is the book Talking Nets, which I found absolutely fascinating. As a journalist looking at this field and reporting on it, the book is a series of interviews with people who have been doing the foundational thinking in this area for decades. It's just really good. It's really interesting. Jeff Hinton tells some fabulous and hilarious stories about his life, which you should read it for no other reason than that. But that's, I think that's my favorite one. Do you have a favorite one, Neil?
I actually have to read Talking Nets. I haven't read it yet. I should read
it. It's good.
So a couple I've got, which are just ones I've been reading recently, and I wouldn't necessarily say go out and buy, but intrigued me because they've got some really interesting people involved, is The Mechanical Mind in History, that's edited by Husbands Holland and Wheeler. And it has all sorts of super cool people in there contributing, including Horace Barlow, member of that Ratio Club we keep talking about. Donald Mickey, who was at Bletchley Park with Turing and Good, and then went on to be a leading figure in University of Edinburgh, was the PhD supervisor of Andrew Blake and many others. Did I mention Margaret Bowden, who's a leading cognitive scientist? Really, and those are just some of the contributors. But that's an edited volume, so maybe some people find them dissatisfying if you're looking for a narrative history. I find them great when you're just looking, mashing around. Another one I got in that spirit, which I think is so critical, is Colossus, which is The Secret of Bletchley Park's Code-Breaking Computers. Now, that is, again, it's an edited volume by Jack Copeland, but it's got so much material. It's 2006 it was published. It's got so much material about what was going on and from people who were there. I just flicked it open, and one of the chapters is Of Men and Machines, Code-Breaking and Colossus. I mean, it's just filled with interesting stories. It's not a single narrative, though, I'd say. It's about breaking the German High Command's code, the Lorenz cipher. That's Lorenz, L-O-R-E-N-Z, not L-A-W-R-E-N-C-E, which they had to do with early digital machines. So one of the things that in Rod Brooks' thing that we were just talking about, he mentions a paper by Turing of 48. Turing was able to write that paper because he'd seen digital machines created at Bletchley Park, and he had the theory, and he knew this was all possible, but he wasn't allowed to tell anyone about it because it was top secret.
Yeah. And I think that that's really interesting that you said that it's not one narrative. It's a bunch of different people who are there. I think that helps you to sort of get away from the history is written by the victors kind of thing, especially with Wikipedia. So if you read widely, read deeply, that'll help to give you a variety of ideas and you can sort of see a fuller picture of what the path has been and who these people were.
But of course, it's not very helpful if someone's looking for one book just to catch up quickly.
No, well, yes, the problem of one book.
Yeah, no, I think there's gonna. I think there's a few things probably in process. You know, after a field's been around, being doing stuff like this, people actually start getting interested in writing such books. So, I think we'll see. I mean, there's probably good stuff if you know good ones there, write in and say ones you've enjoyed. I guess that would be useful. But in terms of definitive things to get us to where we are today, obviously things have been moving quite fast. But I suspect we'll see something coming in the near future.
Yes, definitely. Well, if you've got a question for Talking Machines, or if you've got a favorite book, or you feel like our books are wrong, tweet at us at TLKNGMCHNS or email us at thetalkingmachines@gmail.com. The guest this week on Talking Machines is Arthur Gretton, and he's a professor at the Gatsby Computational Neuroscience Unit, and he's part of the Center for Computational Statistics and Machine Learning at UCL. And when we got a chance to sit down with him, we asked the first question we ask all of our guests: how did you get where you are?
I'm actually, my accent notwithstanding, Australian originally. So I did my undergrad in physics and in engineering at the Australian National University in Canberra. Then I went on to do a PhD in Cambridge, working with Rolf Herbrick, who's currently at Microsoft. Microsoft at Amazon. So he was at Microsoft at the time when we were working on our PhD. So then after that, because the work that I was doing was very much in a good alignment with what Bernard Schulthoff was setting up in Tübingen, I did a postdoc in Tübingen. Then I worked with Carlos Gestrin, sort of combining that kernel toolkit with his graphical model tools. And then I went to Gatsby, where I sort of undermined their Bayesian reputation by being a frequentist.
And you run a lab, yes?
So at Gatsby or at...
You have a group, I believe.
Yeah, yes, yes, yeah, that's right. Yeah. So no, I have a group at Gatsby. And we're sort of working on, sort of ways of looking at various algorithms, so Bayesian inference and testing in a very non-parametric way. Yeah. Mm,
fantastic. And you won Best Paper Award this year, or your team did. Tell me about your research that won that award this year.
Yeah, so this was some really fun research, and it was a sort of last in a long line of research. So the work is on finding how well a model fits data. So obviously, at the moment, we have very complicated data and hence very complicated models. So it's quite important to know when and where your complicated model has failed. So our test is a test that does that. It does it in the event. So when a model becomes complicated enough, it's hard to actually get properly normalized probabilities out of it. Mm-hmm. You can imagine there's a combinatorial number of possible combinations of events. And then from this to get the probability of any given thing requires you to enumerate all these events. So we were able to test where a model fails without having to do that enumeration, without having to compute the probabilities. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
So give us the title of your paper.
So I'm very bad at remembering specifics. So it will be something like a linear time goodness of fit test.
Excellent.
So that's the ballpark of the title.
And you said that this was the last in a long line of research. Are you planning on expanding on this idea, or are you taking a pivot?
So I think... The sort of realm of testing where a model is very complicated, or where data are very complicated, like that is something where there's sort of lots of very fruitful directions to go in. Certainly causality now is a very current topic in fairness and mm-hmm. Also in things like reinforcement learning, because you want to have a causal model of the environment. If I push something, it should fall over according to the laws of physics and so on. So I think that this direction is one that I'm planning to sort of pursue further. Yeah.
Fantastic. Tell me more about what your group is doing. Do you have any questions that you're specifically really excited about?
Sort of complementary to the problem of debugging your model is finding ways to train complicated models.
Right.
As we saw in the present NIPS, adversarial learning is extremely fashionable at the moment. I think it the theory is catching up now with the successes that people have seen in practice. Mm-hmm. So within adversarial learning, there's sort of like refinements to the the code on one hand, but then there has been some interesting work on. Sort of understanding what it's doing and where it fails. And so that direction is one that I'm trying to think about. So recently, we were looking at if one, for instance, uses an adversarial loss to train a generating network that tries to generate images, does that loss give the right gradient? Does it tell it like the right direction to improve in?
Oh.
Or does it actually have a bias? So it's sort of, telling you improve, but it's off by some amount, which sort of makes you drift off to where you shouldn't be. So that's something that we've done very recently. Yeah.
That's fantastic. Excellent. So the Gatsby unit is a very storied place, to say the least. Tell me about how your group fits into sort of the rest of the landscape over there and what you are working on as a community.
So Gatsby is a very storied, institute. It was founded by Jeff Hinton, who, of course, is also, a very sort of fundamental, researcher in deep learning. We are balanced between neuroscience and machine learning, which is quite unusual and was sort of the spirit of NIPS before Cosine. sort of took a lot of the computational neuroscientists away. And I think, the idea remains that insights from neuroscience should inform the machine learning and vice versa. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting threads in computational neuroscience at the moment is understanding how the brain represents and models uncertainty. So this is, I think, the chief area in which my research and the research of others at Gatsby, like Manish Sahani, is presently sort of meshing. So his group and my group are currently sort of in lots of discussions about that, particularly since, you know, the tools that I use are sort of model-free estimates of uncertainty, which might be useful because if we don't know in advance the model the brain uses, we might still be able to get the behavior.
Right. Yeah. It has to be. It has to be flexible enough to make discoveries.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. It's like if we don't know what the model is, but we only have the data.
Right.
And we want to figure out how uncertainty is estimated, you know, just from what we see happening, then some of the tools that I'm working on might be helpful for that. And so, yeah.
That's fantastic. That's excellent. So I mean, that seems like such a fundamental and juicy problem. I don't know if I feel juicy feels like a good word to use.
I think that's
use.
A good word. I like it.
Yes. So in that, in this line of thinking that you and your colleague are pursuing, is there a question that feels like if you could solve that or find a way through this question, that it would open up so many other doors?
One, I think, very challenging problem is testing for when things are conditionally dependent. So it might be, for instance, in the brain that the interaction in processing between auditory and visual stimulus is conditionally dependent on the circumstances that the organism finds itself in. This problem is very hard because, you know, if the coupling between something depends on its input, you know, every input that you see is different to every other. And
right.
So you can't sort of talk about correlations because, you know, correlations change with input you see.
Contextual, right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think this is a problem where there have been results, but it seems still very open. So I think understanding that problem more is going to be like very fundamental for pretty much like, mm-hmm. you know, all of neuroscientific modeling, causal modeling. Fairness measures, you know, the ones that have come out in the last couple of years have
right.
been very dependent on having a good conditional independence test. So I think that's something that really will repay a lot of work. Yeah.
Yeah. So tell me more about the work that we've seen in the last couple of years and around fairness and also this trend around adversarial work. Do you find that these trends are having an impact on the questions that you're asking, given the fact that they're sort of based around this intersection between machine learning and, you know, meat intelligence or how the brain works?
So I find that, so I, in Tübingen, I was like working partly in a neuroscience lab, so in Nikos Logothetis' lab, and at the same time doing machine learning. So I think that it is very difficult to reconcile or to work jointly in both areas in a way that allows you to sort of gain insights about machine learning from the brain. So a much more common mode of collaboration is that neuroscientists have data and they want to analyze
right.
the data.
Yes.
And this, of course, is its own challenge. And this is a very fruitful area in which to apply machine learning.
Mm-hmm.
So I think to sort of think of deeper insights about how the brain processes information arising from machine learning to gain insights into machine learning by seeing how the brain processes things. Like
right.
that's a much tougher challenge. I've found at least that, you know, for the adversarial learning work, I think that is sort of its own thing. And I can't really see how neuroscience and that might work together.
Yeah.
For causal modeling, I mean, this is perhaps where the work that I'm planning on with Manish might then be useful because... Yeah, there you might really get insights in how the brain, you know, the brain is constantly faced with these conditional modeling tasks.
Right.
So, yeah, we might be able to then, like, use that to get insights, yeah.
That's excellent. So I have to admit, I don't know much about Manish's lab. Is he a machine learner? Is he a neuroscientist?
So he is one of the rare people that really works in both areas.
Oh,
so
wow.
He's, yeah, so, you know, and he's done, like, and is doing amazing work, for instance, in modeling the dynamics of the auditory cortex in response
wow.
to, like, you know, inputs. And so, Yeah, so he's really using machine learning tools to get valuable insights into how we process stimuli.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Excellent. And so are you at the phase where you are gathering huge amounts of data and sifting through it together, or are you planning experiments for these contextual causality questions? Or
So he has a lot of links with neuroscience community, mm-hmm. both at UCL and at Stanford. Mm. So I think we are not short of data. Like, we have a great amount of data. I think at the moment we're really developing mathematical tools at this stage. Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Fantastic. So you're on the board for ICML for 2018 coming up. Have you seen any trends this year around the work that you are interested in, the questions that you're asking that you're particularly excited about, or alternatively, things that make you say, oh my God, don't do that. Why are we even talking about that?
One of the topics that was in the air, and I think Ali Rahimi articulated very memorably, was this idea that we should understand. So Ali used, of course, the metaphor of I always say
machine
astrology, but it's
alchemy?
Not alchemy.
Yes,
thank you.
Yes.
So astrology, of course, is much more of a science. Anyway, astrology is also something that gave rise to astronomy in the
right?
same way that alchemy gave rise to glass blowing.
It could have been astrology.
So it could have been
right?
astrology.
Yeah, yep. choose your proto science.
as an anecdote, I was given an ad on my Facebook feed for astrology training. So I think somebody at Facebook is being a bit cheeky.
There's one graduate student twiddling everybody's parameters this weekend.
Yeah, I believe so, yes. I think a point that he made, within this talk, which I found very valuable, is that one should understand one's learning algorithms on a simple problem where you know what the answer is to give insight into more complex problems.
Yeah.
So I think in adversarial networks, the benchmark is, people squinting at blurry pictures of bedrooms. At the moment, I think so, an evolution of this will be when we develop a way of understanding, models, generative model performance in high dimensions, which is systematic and principled. I think a lot of people are working on that.
Mm-hmm.
So this is, I think, and so, but I think what Ali was saying and a reason he got this standing ovation was already very much in the air at NIPS, and he sort of condensed that . So I've noticed a lot of papers now which are sort of taking this principle in optimization, like really trying to understand where it works, where it fails.
Right, yeah.
A nice example of this was there's this algorithm ADAM, which is used by everyone everywhere. And a terrific paper where they said, okay, like here is an instance where it's going to mislead you.
Right.
So these sort of rare features that sort of throw it off.
Ben Recht's paper this year?
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So that was his group. And so that was, so things like that where people sit down and say, okay, like how am I going to break my algorithm?
Right. The sort of bringing the idea, the fundamental idea of a scientific control sort of more into the process of creating these tools.
In fact, like a couple of years back, so there was the AI Stats Conference Christian Robert and I were chairing that. And we wrote in our reviewer instructions that reviewers should reward authors who have a section in their paper where they describe where their method goes wrong.
Oh, this is very good.
Yeah. So tell me why where your method doesn't work and why.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So if I were the theory police, I would make that mandatory across all my papers. But, yeah.
Did you find there was much uptake? Was there a higher percentage of authors who talked about how they broke things?
So I didn't notice any statistically significant increase, unfortunately. But perhaps, this might be, I hope it will be more part of the conversation that people shouldn't feel afraid of saying where their algorithm breaks.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in a lot of academic fields that are traditional, I guess, the conversation around failure is one that's very fraught and doesn't happen a lot because people are highly embarrassed, and also there's grant money on the line, and you can't possibly be shown to be wasting time. So how do we how does the community help to facilitate that here?
Mm-hmm. So perhaps, you know, the discussion around fairness is already sort of showing a path to that. It's like, you know, we have failed in such a damaging way that this will, like, perhaps, you know, cause society not to trust us anymore.
Right.
And so I think that when the consequences of not understanding one's failure modes are sort of clear.
So high.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think a nice example, which I think was in an Atlantic article a little while ago, was in aerospace.
Mm.
So people have been designing planes for a very long time, well before they were able to do, you know, finite element analysis and the modeling that they can do today.
Right.
And so, you know, planes would fall out of the sky.
Right.
And people would then, there was a terrific mechanism put into place where, when a plane fell out of the sky, there was a procedure to be followed. Like failure had a very clear sort of path to diagnosis,
full
to
examination.
Fixing.
Yeah.
This article was very notable because it showed how the NHS in Britain was adopting the procedures that aerospace had used so that when an operation failed and a patient died, rather than the doctor defending their honor and saying, like, you know, it was the nurse's fault.
Right, yeah, right.
Another, I think, nice thing that came up in that discussion was that the nurses were able to challenge the doctors when they had forgotten a procedure. And this idea that a challenge would be listened to and accepted even by a more junior person was valuable. So hopefully in machine learning, the combination of the consequences and perhaps a system like they have adopted in medicine and in aviation might be a way forward.
That's so fascinating, because there's an inbuilt internal system for accountability. Do you think that, I mean, is the community going to have to build its own system for internal accountability?
So I hope that it does. I think, you know, the consequences of not doing so are more and more severe, because we're not playing games anymore. We're creating systems that will drive our cars, diagnose our illnesses, and so on. So I hope that as the stakes sort of rise, it will become standard. People will say, like, you know, I need to know why and where my model fails, because lives are on the line.
Right.
Yeah. And so, you know, perhaps there will require some scandals, as we've seen already, to prompt people to make those choices. But I'm hoping so. Another, I guess, prompt in that direction is the EU law for, you know, interpretable machine decisions. And so that might also help. You know, you need to know where it's going wrong.
Yeah. The internal community standards hopefully become codified or externalized in some way.
Yeah.
Interesting. So do you see, what do you think organizations like NIPS and ICML can do to encourage that? Do we need to sort of have some sort of formalized discussion around it, or should we just sort of keep marching and having workshops on interpretability and hope that people suggest these topics to talk about?
I think that if in the reviewer instructions there is more sort of explicit reward for, revealing one's algorithm's weaknesses, I think that will be, perhaps part of it. Another thing which I think is becoming the case is that code is being released. Like it becomes really embarrassing if you have a complicated algorithm with no code.
This
reveals sort of a multitude of sins, because when the code is out there, people use it and they discover for themselves
it doesn't work.
So I think that this is going to help a lot. I think also that we as a field hopefully have been quite able to conduct like scholarly discussions, even where criticism has been the case. So I think that, Ali Rahimi's, the response to that was not sort of, you know, personal abuse and yelling.
Yeah.
There was of course a big thread on Facebook.
Right.
But I found that that thread was a really productive one and a really constructive one. So, you know, I think that the discussion in the community has been good.
Mm-hmm.
Code release is going to help.
Yes.
So I think we are, What I would like to see is that code release as part of the review process should become mandatory. Oh. So if a reviewer challenges the code should have to be provided by the authors. We did that for AI Stats. It was done in the AI Stats in the following year.
Yeah.
Whether that can be done at the scale of NIPS, I don't know. But I really hope it is.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, these are tractable solutions. These are immediate things that we can do to sort of codify these ideas.
Yeah.
That's really fantastic.
Yeah.
Arthur Gretton, really interesting to hear what he's working on, and also just like amazing to hear about the history of Gatsby and all the stuff that's going on there.
Arthur is like one of my favorite people. He has the best taste in food, and you just have to follow him to restaurants. But also, he is an outstanding researcher. So actually, I've known Arthur since he was a PhD student, because when I was postdocing at MSR, he was working with Ralph Herbrick, who was postdocing at Microsoft. And one of the things I love about Arthur is how little our view of the world overlaps, because he just comes at problems in such a different way from me, and he's absolutely stunningly brilliant. I think when I was a student, I'm like, well, who is this guy and why does he keep saying things I don't understand? And now I'm like, oh, Arthur said another thing I don't understand. Fantastic. Great pleasure to have him. And another example of someone who, you know, he did his PhD here. He's in the UK. He went to the Gatsby. He was in Tubingham for a long period of time with Bernard Shawcock. And, you know, all those things come together to sort of, it's actually a really nice example of why you need things like Ellis, because he's Australian originally, but he's here because of that ecosystem that was, I would say, paramount in the world in those days. And the interesting thing about it now is we're writing letters saying we're not up there yet. You know, it's an interesting checkpoint for me to sort of think about whether that's true and what it all means.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that's it for us this episode. I'm Catherine Gorman.
And I'm Neil Lawrence.
Tune in next episode.